And now, it's time for the Talk of the Northwest, the 9 to noon show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
Hello, and a very good morning to you. 4 minutes past nine, Tuesday the 30th of May, 2023. How are you keeping? You're all well, are you? Roll call? Good. I hope you are anyway. And I hope you're with us now for the next 3 hours on the 9 till noon show. Loads coming up. Different stuff, of course, will be across all the main news stories. We're going to be talking to about barbecuing. We talked about it yesterday. We have a chef coming on. If you have any questions about barbecuing or, you know, something a little bit different or whatever it might be, making coleslaw. How do you make coleslaw? I don't know. I buy it. I'd like to make it. How do you do it? I might ask the chef that. Who's to say if I remember? Potato salad. That would be nice too, wouldn't it? Anyway, we're going to be talking about all things outside culinary. And you can get your questions in too now, by the way, on 086 60 25000. WhatsApps and texts, that's the number for all of your interactions with us today. If you want to give us a call, it's 07491 25000, 07491 25000. As I said to Lee there, we were out kayaking yesterday. Beautiful. Did you do anything nice that you want to share with us? Any recommendations for people who want to do something outside-y? If you know what I mean, whilst the weather is good and if they're in good enough health to do so, you can give us a call to an 074-91-25000, 074-91-25000, and email us on comments at highlandradio.com. Right, let's look at the newspapers for this morning. Let's start with the Donegal Democrat. And Castlefin Councillor Gary Doherty has written to the Minister for Justice, Simon Harris, in relation to mandatory sentencing for criminals and the hurt of the Monegal family and the wider community are feeling at present. He was reacting to the sentencing of Richard Burke to 14 years following his conviction for the manslaughter of mother of two, Jasmine McMonagall, on January 4th, 2019 at Forest Park Killigordon at the Central Criminal Court last Monday. His letter makes it clear that there's a lack of confidence in the current system of dealing with cases like this and calls for mandatory sentencing guidelines for the judiciary to ensure that any person who takes another person's life will face the sentence that they deserve. And I would say, if you put that out to a poll of some description, there's very few people would disagree with that, I think. The Derry Journal this morning: over 50 individuals, groups, businesses, public representatives and clergy in Buncrana and Inishowen have shown their support and extended the warmest welcome to all new residents to the area. Following the recent success with their welcome event in Buncrana, a local group, Buncrana for All, has been engaging with local public representatives, community groups and businesses to address the recent tensions, which they say are created by a very small minority. Local organiser Antonia Smith said Buncrana has experienced some very serious instances in the town recently, with one successful arson and another arson attempt coming within a few days of each other. And I think we're talking about that a little later on in the show this morning. On to the Irish Independent now, and apparently 200,000 cows must be culled to hit climate targets. Startling government documents reveal that dairy farmers may have to be paid €600 million to cull up to almost 200,000 euro cows in a bid to meet Ireland's emission targets. It comes after Agriculture Minister Charlie McConnell-Logue announced plans earlier this year to launch a controversial voluntary dairy exit scheme for farmers. The figures for the plan, revealed in an internal Department of Agriculture paper and obtained under freedom of information by the Farming Independent, warn that the tougher measures would be needed if the farming sector is to reach its 2025 emissions reduction targets. The paper says that 65,000 cows must be culled over the next 3 years at a cost of €200 million annually. The suckler beef herd is already in decline, but a 10% reduction in the dairy herd is now needed after successive government encouraged its expansion. So what's the feelings amongst the farming community about that? I mean, obviously, they're pricing compensation for it, 200,000 less cows. And is that then milk that we export and milk products that we export? Are we going to be exporting less? Is that what is consumed internally? So are we going to be importing more? Like, if you take 10% of the dairy herd out of the equation in this country, it's going to affect the market. So does this mean that we're going to start importing milk now to meet our emissions targets? Or does that mean we're not exporting our produce anymore. And what's the benefit in that? I mean, obviously there's the climate benefit, but every action has a reaction. So what are the ramifications? Where's that 10% of productivity going to go? If you know, 086 60 25,000, 086 60 25,000. On to the Irish Times now. And an average of 88 Ukrainian refugees continue to arrive in Ireland every day, senior officials will tell an Oireachtas committee today, with arrivals expected to continue as the war continues. More than 83,000 Ukrainians have now been granted temporary protection orders, and more than 61,000 of these have been provided with accommodation around the country. Officials will tell the Oireachtas Committee on Equality and Integration that this is the equivalent of the population of County Carlow. Every person who has asked for shelter from our department continues to receive it, with daily average arrivals presently standing at 88 as the conflict develops. We expect arrivals to continue, officials will tell the committee, according to opening statements circulated last night. So there are currently 83,000 Ukrainians that have come here since the war began. 61,000 of those have had to been provided with accommodation, and a further 88 on average arrive into this country per day. On to the Irish Daily Star now. And Housing Minister Dara O'Brien has reminded homeowners that legal action can be taken against them if they do not have adequate permission to rent homes out on Airbnb. Now, as we mentioned on this programme before, a quick search of properties available for rent on daft.ie will show you there are a handful of houses effectively to rent in Donegal. But if you check out Airbnb, for an example, there are over 1,000 properties available for short-term rents. Now, I think it's fair to point out that a lot of those would not be suitable permanent accommodation. Some of them are mobile homes, some of them are little chalets, some of them are rooms in homes, you know what I mean? So it's not, I don't think a direct comparison of the two figures is actually accurate and is perhaps a little bit of fake news. I think if you're going to look at those figures, you would need to strip out Airbnb properties that aren't suitable for long-term rental. And I don't know what the figure might be at that point. But anyway, there is apparently legislation which means you must get planning permission. Nothing's ever really come of it, has it? I think it might have been one prosecution or what have you. But anyway, the Housing Minister's reminding people that that legislation there is there. It comes after it was revealed yesterday that there are 8 times more homes available for short-term lease than there are for long-term tenants. An analysis of Airbnb showed more than 8,100 full properties suitable for families were available around the country, which is good because on a national level they have looked at those figures, and I think that it's important to distinguish between the different types of property. But that being said too, there is a housing crisis in this country, and it's because not enough houses have been built. And then when we start talking about what people can do with their own property, is it an overreach? You know, I mean, if you decided that you don't trust banks and you invested in a property and then you want to sort of get some sort of a return on that, should you be told what to do with it by government, who is responsible for actually providing houses? They're trying to tell you what to do with your house to fix a problem that they should build more houses to fix. Now, I'm not saying that's an opinion of mine, but just when I read this, when we start talking about what people can actually do with their own properties. Now, I don't, by the way, just for absolute certainty, I don't have any additional properties or income, by the way. I'm just saying there's no interest in it for me. I'm just saying, you know, if I can imagine if I were in that situation. We're going to talk about this a little bit later on, but I want, if you don't mind, you to share your real life experiences as well. And it's one we've talked about on this program numerous times before, and it's voluntary contributions at school. Now, I think we all know, don't we, that they're not voluntary at all, really. And certainly when they're being demanded, dependent on which school you're dealing with, they're not really phrased as voluntary. They're called charges or whatever it might be. I haven't received one of the texts for quite some time, but you don't really feel, do you, that you can opt out of them? And clearly many parents don't, because 90% of parents cut spending to pay school fees. Nearly 90% of parents say they had to cut back or delay spending in order to pay school voluntary contribution charges for their children. Research from the Society of St. Vincent de Paul found that the annual fees average from €30 to €550 per student, with an average of €140 per child. The findings were published in the Closing the Gap, What is Needed to End Voluntary Contribution in Post-Primary School Report. So is that something that's a problem for you? And also, too, you know, when you get into transition year, which I think is beneficial, it is beneficial for students, but it's expensive, isn't it? And it's hard to say no. And I wonder, do people sort of try and skip transition year to try and avoid those extra costs? I don't know. If you want to share in confidence your real life experiences, as I say, WhatsApp and text 086 60 25,000. Just to remind you too, by the way, that shortly I have one more paper to go and then a quick break. We're going to be speaking to the guys at Coleman Legal to find out if there's any progress in relation to their class action. It's not a class action because one doesn't exist in this country, but it is really effectively a class action as it relates to compelling certain individuals and groups, certain groups certainly, authority and what have you, to pay the full cost of repairing people's defective concrete affected homes. So if you have any questions for Coleman Legal, because it was mentioned on the programme yesterday, and I committed to get answers for you, we're going to do that. So get your questions into us on 086 60 25,000. But finally, some good news. If you like drinking tea, and who doesn't? Not that I get tea on this programme, but anyway, I have to beg for it. Drinking two cuppas a day helps protect the memory as we age, scientists have found, which is good news. Naturally occurring chemicals in tea called flavanols boost brain power and help with recall. The effect is the same if the tea is taken black or white, so it doesn't matter if you put milk in. Experts arrived at the findings after studying how flavanols, also found in apples and berries, affected the memory of over 1,500 healthy over 60s. So you don't have to drink your tea. An apple a day helps your memory as well. So tea and apples, that's the future, folks. All right, 086 60 25,000, WhatsApps and texts. Good morning to Annie, Patricia, Paul and Marie, amongst those watching our live stream of the show. You'll be able to see our next guest and most of our guests throughout the course of the morning by logging on to YouTube, Highland Radio Ireland. You can watch us on your phone, tablet, laptop, your smart TV, which should have the app, or indeed you can watch us on your Fire Stick. We're across Facebook, Highland Radio News and Sport and Highland Hub, and you can click, there's a little watch live button on our website. So why not interact with us that way if you're able to do so? We start this morning with very sad news. A man killed in a workplace explosion in Gwydor yesterday has been named locally as Stephen Montgomery. Mr. Montgomery, who was just 43 years of age, was a married man with a grown-up child and was from Dunfanaghy. He was working, breaking up rock while working at a house at a site at Bloody Foreland yesterday when tragedy struck. It's understood that Mr. Montgomery was operating machinery when an explosion occurred. The emergency services rushed to the scene while Gardaí sealed off the area. The Health and Safety Authority also confirmed that they were aware of the incident and had sent investigators to the site, as it was a workplace incident. And members of the Irish Defence Forces Explosives Ordnance Disposal were also requested to attend the scene. Now, it's not really clear at this point exactly the circumstances surrounding this tragedy. The parish priest in Gwydor is Father Brian O'Farrey, and he joins us on the programme now. Father, thank you so much for taking this call this morning. But it's another dark, sad day, isn't it?
You're most welcome, Greg, and thank you very much for having me with you. It certainly is. It's a sad day for our community. There's a blanket of sadness from yesterday lunchtime, and Stephen, today is the news is filtering through the name of the gentleman that lost his life yesterday, Stephen Montgomery. So that there's an air of sadness in our community, certainly. Yeah.
And Father, you were called to the scene yesterday.
I was. Yesterday was. I started the day, as I'm going to start here today as well. I was going around visiting the sick and the elderly and the housebound, and in around the Derrybeg area, and around about midday, just shortly after midday, I got a phone call on my mobile phone to tell me that there was an incident in Crockfalla, in the area of Crockfalla, and that if I would attend the scene there, and I said I would certainly. So I made my way, I know where the locality is, and I made my way through Derrybeg, through Carrick, Brunelliac, into Crockfalla, and met there by three workmen on site, and they were visibly shocked and sadness as well, and they informed me that person had died, and I did what any priest, I suppose, or any member of the clergy or any minister would do. And that I prayed my prayers and administered the last rites as best I could. And then I stood back at that stage, and the Garda Síochána arrived on scene, and I knew then that that was my place to step back and to allow the Gardaí and the fire brigade who landed and the ambulance services to continue their work.
And it's awful news for Stephen's family and friends to hear and have to process, and it's really just right now they're dealing with that as we speak, but also you know, friends and work colleagues and those who responded to the scene, Father Breen, I beg your pardon. It's a tragedy that affects so many people. And of course, too, and the way it was phrased from An Garda Síochána in terms of this being an explosion at the location, though we don't know exactly the circumstances of that, too. There's an awful lot of people affected by the Chrysler tragedy, where Stephen didn't live too far from, of course, that it affects. It's just one of those awful tragedies that impacts so many.
You're right. You know, and I'm speaking with you this morning, I'm very conscious. I'm conscious of the sadness that surrounds us here in Gador, but I'm equally conscious of Stephen's family and friends and colleagues and the circle of family there that are just plunged into that all-encompassing sadness. Because, I mean, what we have here was a man who left home, and I understand that he was a married man and a father. He left home, he left a wife, he left a family, he left his people yesterday morning, maybe around about this time or a bit earlier, whatever it was, and just left to go into a decent and an honest day's work and labour. And it came to a very tragic end, sadly, that he was working in an excavator machine and clearing the sites for house extension and so on. And now I don't know how it occurred, and it's not my place to say anything on that. I know that Garda investigations are undergoing, and in due course they'll deliberate on those investigations that are under place. And can I just say as well that I commend, you know, the dedication and the professionalism of An Garda Síochána and all the emergency services that I witnessed there yesterday, the National Ambulance Service, the Brigade Dóiteáin an Ghiúr, the Donegal Fire Brigade, who attended at the scene of the incident, that they worked so professionally and with great dedication as well, as they always do. Mm-hmm. It was sadly, we have the results that we have today, and that Stephen had died.
Okay, and Father Breen, not easy for you to attend a scene like that, so we'll include you in our thoughts and prayers as well. Thank you for joining us this morning.
You're most welcome, and thank you as well. And just and I'm sure that all your listeners will join me and join you, Greg, as well, and just offering a prayer for the happy repose of the soul of the deceased, but also the family that are affected, because there's sadness and sorrow and shock and numbness in that family. And even though they're not from, that Stephen is not from Gador here, but at times like this, you know, parish boundaries fall into insignificance, and people are supported, and we embrace that family, and going forward, we're there for them in whatever way we can. Thank you.
Okay, Father Breen O'Farrey, thank you very much indeed for joining us. And as I say, we are all thinking on Stephen's family and friends today. Okay, moving on now, we're joined on the programme by David Coleman, founder and managing partner with Coleman Legal. Thank you so much for joining us, David. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Greg.
Right, okay. Now, yesterday we had a conversation with representatives from the Mica Action Group, and it's off the back of a social media post that they had put out. And they're not discouraging people per se from engaging with the scheme, and I want to paraphrase this correctly, but what they are saying, I think, is that they see the best opportunity for people to get 100% redress is through the action which Coleman Legal is taking on behalf of many, many homeowners. And the question was, the suggestion was made that they should contact your company. And then some people said they weren't clear or not whether you were taking on new clients. So let's just cut to the chase on that one. A bit late for that, though, with that introduction. But are you still accepting new clients, Dave?
Yeah, short answer, Greg, is yes, we are. The case is the only opportunity for people to achieve justice through equality of arms and parity of esteem. We've put together world-renowned experts. We've 9 people working on our legal team on this case. We've access to specialist counsel for European law, planning law. It's free for everybody to join. They don't have a cost risk. They did initially. Excuse me. They did initially, but there is no cost risk now. So there's no downside, really. It's a unique and groundbreaking case, Greg. Mm. As you know, it's private. It's fully funded on a not-for-profit basis. And private in the sense that only those in the case are entitled to benefit from the results of the case in the first instance. And at some point, we will close off. We've just crossed 1,800 in the case now. And our view has always been that 2,000 is a good number. And having had discussion with MAG, and we're very thankful and grateful for their support, we have decided that what we will do is we will then announce a sort of cut-off period so that people who haven't joined still have the opportunity to do so. But we're coming to the time when, unfortunately, because our resources are finite, it will have to close.
You mentioned how there's no risk now. This is in terms of people finding themselves, you know, having to cover costs or what have you. This is off the back of a recent ruling, is it? Can you just give us, firstly, what was said and the significance of that and maybe the context of the case?
Well, it's a unique event in Irish law, what happened. And it's this, that if ever a citizen or a person in Donegal wishes to take a high court case and they lose, they are responsible for the costs of the winner, the loser pays principle. However, in this instance, it was agreed between the defendants, the NSAI, Cassidy's and DCC, Donegal County Council, that in fact, they would not have to incur any costs in putting in an appearance to each claim, and we wouldn't pursue judgment absent the appearance of each claim. So that agreement is holding in the main. And what that means for people is that they have no downside risk on an adverse costs order against them, which is a huge weight off people's shoulders. It's been tough enough, Greg, without the legal bills that may or may not happen. They will not happen. That's the message.
Now, some people were saying, yes, but this doesn't include everyone because I didn't get my blocks from a particular supplier or I'm living in Derry or Tyrone or whatever it might be. So is there anyone that doesn't qualify to join this action?
Yeah, there are, Greg, in one sense and in another not, and I'll explain. The case is against, as a block supplier, it's against Cassidy's. And there are other firms out there supplying blocks. And we do have some people who are complaining about the quality of the blocks from these places. And we're not quite sure whether there was an element of what we call white labelling going on, that in fact the quarries themselves have no problems with their blocks, but that they may, in a short-term arrangement, have asked Cassidy's to supply blocks for a particular customer.
I think I can say with a degree of certainty that that did certainly happen place, yeah.
Yeah, so therefore, is it viable to start taking individual cases against individual quarries when this could well turn out to be the case? So what we believe people should do is that they should reach out again, because our knowledge is increasing all the time in this area, and that if they have had blocks from another supplier and those blocks are affected, they're faulty in some way, we will look at it again. And we don't want to leave people behind. That's not the purpose of the case.
But can they join now? And second to that, too, there is a group of individuals who maybe purchased a property or don't have any evidence as to where the blocks came from. You know, they didn't hold on to a receipt or what have you. And I'm not trying to pick holes, but it is the sort of individual cases that might be more inclined to message in as we have this conversation. So just in regards to not being able to prove where you got your blocks from or you have no evidence of that, where does that leave you in this case?
We've no trouble with answering that or dealing with it. And the reason is this, that it's great when people do have receipts. But honestly, when you're building your house and you're 20 years on, to think that you kept your block receipts, Greg, is a stretch. That's number one. But number two, and more importantly, the geological makeup of each block is unique to the area from which the stone was drawn. Mm. So we can show immediately, even sometimes by looking at the, at it, that if this is a Cassidy's block.
Now, how is it progressing? And when I know from my last conversation with you that actually it is moving perhaps slightly quicker than one might have imagined, but this is a process that has to be gotten through and the wheels of justice can turn quite slowly.
Well, no, you're absolutely right, Greg. I'm happy to tell you that there is a timetable agreed as between all defendants. And we are rigidly sticking to that timetable, as indeed are most of the defendants. And the great thing about that is that it's now incumbent upon all defendants to lodge their defence to the claim now. They have about 6 weeks within which to do it. And that really is that this is a turning point in the case, because we've had to set our case out. We spent a year and a half preparing it and we're quite satisfied with what we're saying and what we're doing. It's incumbent on the defendants now to reach out and say how they intend to defend this case. And I just, if I could pause there for a moment, Greg, because, you know, one has to ask, why is Dave Coleman on the radio? Why are we here? And this isn't a fight with the government, Greg. This is a search for justice for all. And governments will come and go, as you know, but the problems in Donegal are only going to grow. Both the state, through the NSAI and Donegal County Council, and the people of Donegal are destined to have an epic clash in the courts in Ireland, of which it's certain there will be no winners. The people, we believe, will get what they're entitled to. That's not a victory. That's just getting what you're entitled to. And the state, they'll have to watch as years of regulation and are publicly paraded throughout Europe and beyond. Like the listeners not involved in this case, who have no skin in the game, they do not wish to see Ireland Inc. thrown under a bus like this, because people are taking sides. There are no sides here. We want to be very, very clear that the ideal outcome is that jaw-jaw here is better than war, and people should talk.
Do you think that this is being taken, we'll just use the government for an example, or the state, or however it's phrased, is this being taken seriously to the point whereby they could be brought to the table at some point?
The way we're running the case, Greg, is unfortunately to fight it. And no lawyer should ever take a case unless he's willing to have a judge give an opinion on the rights and wrongs of it. And we are doing this, and we will continue to do it. And the state know we're heavily funded, and that they know we have the right experts, and they know that we're heading for a clash. And I'm not calling out the state to say that they're wrong, but what I am saying is that they should be negotiating. There was previous negotiations with civilians without legal or technical representation, which led to a government and, dare I say, a civil service-led grant scheme, not a redress scheme. It's a completely different thing. Redress applies to everybody. Grant is who qualifies and who is told qualifies. It's a whole different ballgame. And we're not trying to, try to win this on the airwaves. But it's a clear clarion call for logic to prevail here, rather than we all have a go at one another on the floor of the High Court.
Well, it is fascinating because I have no legal background whatsoever, but it would be fascinating to see how, on behalf of the government, a defence is put forward and on what grounds. And because you have to be very careful, I presume, how they position themselves because of who we're talking about and the potential consequences or the ramifications or admittance in certain areas or whatever it might be.
Well, that's just it. I mean, we have looked at we've looked at it from the other side, Brett, as to what are they going to tell us. We fairly know what they're going to write in their defence, and you know it is sort of betting the house on this defence, because if they're wrong here, they're wrong in so many other aspects of their relationship with their citizens, and it's a defining moment for citizens and the relationship of government and regulation. And who's entitled to what level of care?
Because we were told at the time of the first scheme that, I want to say we, I just use that as a term, that, you know, you better accept this. You really need to accept this, because if you don't, we're going to have to change legislation. And if we change legislation, that's going to take 5 or 6 years. That was the public defence for not giving 100% redress. Now, I presume no one's going to stand up in a court of law and say that, but it'd be very interesting to find out how you would defend that position. Now, I'm not saying even that might come up in this, but do you know what I mean? That's what people were being told. They were saying, if you don't take this, you might not get anything.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, it comes down to the two things, the quality of arms and parity of esteem. You know, when somebody's telling you, you get a grant if you qualify, and if you don't like it, you're not getting it. That's not equality of arms. That's not parity of esteem. This case is both. We can match them toe for toe on any of the legal or technical expertise that's required here. And it's a different ballgame. Now, we don't want to win. We want to have a proper system of justice and put in place here with redress for all. And that's not a win. Because if you have winners and losers, Greg, it's more difficult to deal with something. Like, we have to engage maturely and objectively. And we need to put the past behind us.
Question marks have been raised and have been sent in to us here again about the legality of third-party funding and contingency fees in Ireland. Could you address that for us?
Absolutely, yeah. So it's a bit of an old trope at this point, Greg, where millions spent down the road. The state are engaging with us in a very, very objective and reasonable way. For example, the Dropbox for appearances, saving people money and risk. So, you know, if they had something to say to us about legal funding, they would have said it. That's the first thing. The second thing is that well before we embarked on this action, we took our own views in relation to the type of funding we were doing and what's allowed by law in Ireland. And, you know, the proof of the pudding is in the eating, and that we have had no issues. Nobody's raised it once. And we firmly believe that nobody is going to raise the funding here, because it's not for profit. It's for the public good. The courts we've been in and out, let's say, 15 times into court already, and the judge has not been appraised of any issues, and this is not going to arise in this case.
And you would imagine it would have been suggested at this point to put an early end to the whole thing if it were if the defendant thought there was
if they thought they could, Greg, they would, and they know they can't and won't.
Yeah. If your house isn't, I can't. This listener can't afford to test their house, but you know yourself that I think they've come to the conclusion that they must have a MICA. Can they sign up with Coleman Legal even if they haven't had a test done yet?
Oh, 100%. If you have a fear that your house is contaminated, sign up. You're not going to be forced at your own expense to get a test done. There's going to be a system in place if we win, and we believe we will, or if we settle, and we believe we will, that you know, that it's taken out of your hands. It's impossible to ask an ordinary citizen who may have given his life, paying his taxes, doing his job, to become now a building contractor and to ensure his house is built to a certain standard. There has to be a proper system in place. It's not there, Greg. It's not even slightly there.
A caller says, when you send in your form to the County Council for defective blocks now, you have to state whether you are on with Dave Coleman or another representative, and state that you won't accept any additional money apart from what the government gives you. Is this correct? Have you?
No. That's either a misinterpretation by the council or by the caller. Of course, nobody's entitled to double compensation, and we were very clear about that. When the legislation...
This is the shortfall we're talking of, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. We're only claiming for the shortfall. So if the grant is given, the grant is subtracted from any redress scheme that's available.
And this is a question I was very keen to get an answer to yesterday, and I'm glad to have the opportunity to ask you today. Would the beer, if successful, would there be a retrospective element to this? Because if there were not, I can see people not wanting to necessarily progress in this scheme until such time as there is an agreement or a ruling. So do you expect that someone who maybe has had to dig into their savings or to borrow, say, for an additional 40,000, 50,000 euro, and they're currently paying that back now, if you're successful in this action, would they be compensated retrospectively, do you think?
Well, let's say, for example, a homeowner had to replace their outer leaf, Greg, because clearly that was the damage. And the wisdom at the time was, replace the outer leaf and it'll be fine. Of course, we'll be claiming for the outer leaf. And that one of our lead cases, the O'Doherty case, is just that. it's an outer leaf and a problem and a defective block case. So of course we're looking for all out of pocket expenses, and there are many elements to that, including, you know, the house rental, the storage costs, the general damages for what people have to go through. I mean, their houses are destroyed. Their lives have to be rebuilt in some ways.
Yes, this could end up, if successful, far more expensive for the government, for an example, than a actual 100% redress scheme, because this would catch more stuff than perhaps a broadly welcomed 100% redress scheme might.
I know you might feel I'm splitting a hair, Greg, but it's not 100% redress. Well, it's 100% grant.
I know, but it's not Micah either. We say that. You know what I mean? Yeah, I get you.
Oh, no, 100%. I do know what you mean, Greg. But, you know, even in the Dáil, they call it a redress scheme and they know, well, it's a grant scheme and it applies to few. So, you know, it has to change, and it will change, or we'll have to go to Europe to change it.
All right, language is important, though, so I appreciate the clarification. Right. No, you're perfectly right. I'm not precious. I like to be able to use the right words going forward. Negligence by surveyor regarding Micah House was bought a few years ago. Surveyor said there was no deleterious material. Is there a timeline to take a case? Does the two homeowners have to consent to such a case? I think this is not part of the action that you're taking. Sorry, I read that believing it were. But do you have any advice for them just whilst
I do, Greg. In fact, we are suing some surveyors in sidebar actions and other professionals for their efforts or lack of effort in relation to advice given to homeowners. I mean, it's tough enough for people to have the problem that they do, but when they rely on professionals who give them poor advice, of course they have rights. Now, they would want to be careful of the time, Greg. You have 6 years from the date of, discovery of the problem. And if you're a second-hand homeowner, it's more complex then if the first damage was done, you know, by the previous owner, if you know what I mean, or their advisors. So each case has to be seen on its merits, but most certainly they should be doing something about that.
Okay, just another couple of more questions, then I won't hold you very much longer. What rights do council tenants have where the house has severe issues with defective blocks and the council... are all correspondents, but anyway, but just up to that point, where do people in social housing fall into this?
Well, the Housing Act of 1966 says that the local authority has to provide an accommodation that is safe and fit for human habitation. Once the property falls below that benchmark, the onus is on the council then to rehouse, repair, or make good whatever the issues are. So yes, people do have rights. They're not sitting ducks or as sitting tenants, not at all.
All right. Can you ask Mr. Coleman, we're selling our house and had to get it tested. It came back 17% mica, but we can't get on any scheme as there's no actual damage to the property. That's an awful catch-22 there, it seems.
Yes, there's a lot of that. What they ought to do is... So they have a test, which says 17%. Well, they should sign up for the case because every person has a duty to mitigate their loss. And the only way you can do it is if you assert your rights. And the only way you can assert your rights is if you join the case. And you know, it is a very tough bind because people generally selling, Greg, need to sell.
Yeah, and they're an awful situation there. And very finally, I recently bought a house. I was living abroad and we were returning home to live and bought it online via an estate agent. Neighbours now tell us the estate has mica. Some houses are in worse conditions than others. I bought it 3 months ago. What can I do?
Make contact.
Okay.
I mean, when you think of it, Greg, 3 months ago, 120 days ago, how long have you been talking about this on your show?
Yeah.
That's appalling. Yeah, make contact.
Okay. Dave, thanks very much for your time today. I think we covered everything. And I think really that the parting message is here that there has to be a cap at some point, and you're really sort of down to the last 10%. So if there are people, and it's a broad net that you're casting, really, as we heard from some responses to those questions coming in. If people want to be part of this, they would really need to get in contact now. So how do they do so, Dave?
Defectiveblocks at ColemanLegal.ie, or just contact the firm ourselves. And we have a call centre available to people. It works very, very well. It's a user-friendly service. So, yeah, people are welcome.
Thanks for your time, Dave. That's Dave Coleman, founder and managing partner with Coleman Legal. Now, a report carried out on behalf of the Society of St. Vincent de Paul has found that 87 40% of parents have had to cut back or delay spending in order to pay the voluntary contribution charge at school. The report published today and conducted by Grant Thornton was developed from an online parent survey and in-depth case studies with the principals of six post-primary schools. 1,447 parents responded to the online survey for the report titled Closing the Gap, What is Needed to End Voluntary Contribution in Post-Primary Schools. Voluntary contributions, for those of you who aren't aware, are charges, payments made by parents towards schools to cover costs that the school incurs outside of its funding. Now, you know, I think sometimes parents will question, really, what's going on? We don't know the figures. We haven't seen the figures. Let's see the books. Let's see the shortfall in your school year, and let's see how much you take from parents, how that matches. Do you have any left over? Where's that money going? You know what I mean? I think there certainly needs to be a bit more transparency in this. But Rose McGowan is St. Vincent de Paul National President and joins us on the programme now. Rose, thanks for your time.
Not at all. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, and before we get to the findings of this survey, I mean, you know, this is a big burden on families, but we don't really know what we're paying for, where it's going, how it all balances things out, which I think in the first instance, I'd really like to know that.
Yeah, I suppose, I mean, I visit like all of the other members every week. And from this time, in fact, in my own conference, which is the group that visits in a parish, we had our first request last week where school is finishing now, TYs have finished, the letters are coming out for books and voluntary contributions, etc., etc. So it puts huge, huge pressure on a family. And while they were always under pressure, even last year, you can imagine the pressure this year with energy costs, with food increases. So it puts huge pressure, plus the other side is huge stress on family life as well, and stress leads to medical sides of stuff. So every parent, I think we all have children, every parent wants to make sure that their child has a good education, but also that they're not different. And that's what we find. They're under pressure to pay this because the child feels, if I don't pay, you know, there's something could be said in school. And just two very simple examples are, in a lot of schools, when we ask what voluntary contribution covers, now, while it covers a lot of things, but it covers things like photocopying, but the biggies are things like lockers and homework journals. So, like, if you don't pay the voluntary contribution and the teacher says to the child, where's your homework journal? And they say, well, I forgot it, or they might be asked the second day. Sure, of course, everybody in the class knows they didn't pay the voluntary contribution. That's hugely stressful on the child, and immediately they're made to feel different. And I know in some of the families I visit, they don't want to go to school unless the voluntary contribution is paid. Mm. So what we find with the parents, they're cutting back on food. Maybe they don't pay their rent, or, you know, they don't pay part of the bill that they pay every week. So it's really juggling, you know, all of the time.
And also, you know, it's not like it's made very clear. Some schools might refer to it as a fee. Levy is another word that I've seen used. It's not always made very clear that this is a voluntary contribution scheme. And you talk about children being treated equal, and when you average everything out, one of the most expensive years is transition year. And it's an incredibly important year for students. I think there's an awful lot of growth and development, and sometimes it means that the leaving cert doesn't come too early in their young lives. But there are families having to make the decision to skip that, to forego it. That puts an awful lot of pressure on the student because they're losing a friends group potentially. And they're also being maybe arguably missing out on opportunities. Now, I know when we talk about maybe a trip to Italy or whatever, not everyone goes on that. And that's not necessarily what we're talking about here. But it does. It is a year I have particular concerns about for people under incredible financial pressure.
Yeah, no, and we totally agree. I mean, we would see transition year, as you say, as developing that student. And particularly in certain areas and disadvantaged areas, they may not have that kind of opportunities that maybe children in other areas would have. So things like the couple of weeks that they do work experience, or, you know, that gives them an opportunity to think, what would I like to do? And also people don't think about the small things. So on TY a year, there's a fee for TY, but then there's also the voluntary contribution. So there's a double whammy there. And I think the other thing that people don't think about is if you're going to work experience, you know, you have to be dressed, you have to, you know, there's travel, there's all those little things that cost money. It's money on top of money. And I suppose the other thing is that we would want those children to really benefit from that year. As you say, leaving cert could be 16 or 17. Sure, how could you make a decision on what you do in third level, whether it be a PLC or a trade or university? Like, they're too young to make those decisions. It's a hugely important year. Mm. And yes, lots of families will skip it. They just can't afford it. And they do worry about that foreign trip, which doesn't worry us as much. Look, you don't have to go on a foreign trip. But the other things, the local outings, whether it be to the historical place, like, yeah, there's lots of things involved in that, doing the Angoshka Awards, which I just think it's a super award.
Yeah, and Rose,
part of it, you know, that you do, that's something new to learn, you know?
Yeah, and you know, in the cost of living crisis we have, and it affects us here, particularly in the Northwest, if you don't mind me saying so, because of low wages, low disposable income. Yeah. And we have record numbers of working families now accessing food banks, which themselves are struggling. And we often talk about when you have the least... we talk about, you know, how you deal with emergency things like, you know, a tyre needing replaced on a car, your washing machine breaking down. The thing that worries you and is a concern, and it should not be a voluntary charge to a school in this day and age. I mean, the government is awash with money, we're told. Has anyone costed how much it would cost the Department of Education to properly fund schools? Although this is where it starts getting complicated, and I would love, as I say, a bit more transparency on this money and where it's spent and how it actually goes into schools' balance sheets. But anyway, do we have a cost as to how much it would cost the Department of Education to bridge this gap for parents and schools?
Yeah, we are in the process. We, like all charities, we would do a pre-budget submission, so we're costing all of that. But one of our big things in our pre-budget will be to increase the capitation grant to ensure that schools can meet those running costs. I mean, at the moment, schools would say to us, they're using the voluntary contribution to keep the lights on. Like, you know, that shouldn't be the case. And the capitation grant was lowered a few years ago, and it has, you know, there has been a small increase, but it has never come back to what it was. And it's not just to come back to that, it needs to be increased. And I suppose what one of the things we're looking for is, like, to establish a procurement support service for schools. You know, I mean, we must be able, if schools were together and there was certain firms that you use, you have to get better deals, you know. And what you've said there is important. We need transparency on educational funding expenditure, and we will be looking for that, you know, going forward.
Yeah, and just a parting message here, a caller says, all I hear is that this is a voluntary donation. Last year, my daughter was called, along with a lot of others from her class, to ask for payment. Now, a child should not be exposed to that. That's not good, and that's not voluntary, because they're going home and they become the debt collector for the school to mom and dad and or whoever is caring for them in the house. That's unacceptable behaviour. That.
Yeah, and I mean, that's what we have to think in all of that, because in fact, it hugely affects the child. But when the child goes home, it hugely affects the parents. And you know, parents want the very best for their children, so that's why they're cutting back on everything. And you're correct about that. This isn't just about people who might be on social welfare. Like, we have lots and lots and more of low income families coming to us, and that is correct. We're here to help people, so it's affecting everybody. You know, if you think that, you know, your voluntary contribution could be €300, and we'll say you have two children, they're €600. It's not the €200. It doubles depending on how many children you have. So that's a huge, huge in anybody's budget, whether it's social welfare or low pay, or in fact you know, people earning a good salary when they have mortgages and all sorts.
Yeah, okay. Rose McGowan, thanks for your time. I appreciate it. Rose McGowan is president of St. Vincent de Paul, the national president there. Any views on that? 086 60 25,000, WhatsApps and texts to that number, or call 07491 25,000. I mean, you know, this is a funding shortfall from government to schools. Why should parents who are already struggling? You know, the list is building here as to so many people listening to this programme today, that everyday pressures that they're under. You know, we talk about the nice weather and it gives us a lift, and I get that. But the way this country is set up sometimes, are people able to enjoy it, worrying about this, that and the other? Right, as I say, though, we want you involved in the conversation. You know the numbers there. Right, a quick comment before we go to the break. An Airbnb house in my area had 8 cars at it over the weekend. Just imagine how much water was used in that house in that time. The water pipe supply in this area was never meant to cater for that much water being used. Small businesses have to pay rates. I just wonder how many Airbnb houses are registered as a business and paying VAT or rates. Interesting question.